Hey, this is Matt.
And this is Bill.
And you're about to enter the DMZ.
It's a warm and cozy place.
It is warm and cozy. And even today, when in Washington, D.C., it is warm and sunny outside, I still find myself taking comfort hiding in the safe and warm confines of the DMZ.
So
I've been hearing a lot of DMZ talk lately, by the way. I'm a huge the Apple TV for Christmas. So now I'm watching a ton of Netflix streaming stuff,
and they just put the Apple TV.
Oh, it's great. Basically, and there are other ways to do it. It's not just the Apple TV, but essentially the Apple TV allows you to watch Netflix, things that would be on your laptop, on your big TV, on your flat screen. And for you can also hook it up, like my iPhone is hooked up to it, right? So if I'm watching a YouTube clip of Ryan Adams performing on Dave Letterman on my iPhone, I can now project it onto my big screen TV. Same thing with pictures. I could take a picture on my iPhone and just click a button and it goes up there. But a lot of it's for streaming Netflix right now. And the A-Team, the old A-Team TV show, they just added that. And a lot of DMZ talk. I didn't realize
it.
A lot of talk about the DMZ. Yeah. We're sort of like the Blogging Hits A-Team.
It's very similar.
Similar. I'm like B.A. Baracus, I guess. We're fakes. I don't know. I think of you as more Hannibal or Murdoch, depending on the movie.
Is that a compliment? I think it's a compliment.
Well, Hannibal is a compliment. Okay. He was super... Hannibal... I think Hannibal was the coolest of the characters. And in fact, there was talk that George Clooney should portray him in the movie. Mm. Sadly, that didn't happen. But I do think Hannibal's the coolest of the candidates. I'm so politically obsessed of the actors, of the characters.
Well, I think there was one big political story overnight. And I feel like everything I've read about it has not really enlightened me about what happened. And that's the Nebraska Senate race where the establishment favorite, the state attorney general, he was defeated. The conservative upstart that was backed by Jim DeMint, he was defeated. And this woman named Deb Fischer, who seemed to be the least well-funded, but had Sarah Palin's backing, she eked out the victory, and even the Democratic Party's messaging against her is just that she's unknown and untested. They don't even seem to be having a real big, ideological hit on her. Do you have any insight what happened here? And what is this similar to what happened in Indiana when it was, the Tea Party conservatives pushing out the establishment relative moderate? Is this similar to Joe Miller and Christine O'Donnell? Or is this altogether different that's going on in Nebraska that folks aren't quite getting?
It's altogether different. Essentially, what you had is a guy named John Bruning, who was the establishment candidate, kind of an establishment moderate. But the waters were muddied because he was also endorsed by Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum. So that confused things. Then you had a guy named Don Stenberg, who was the real conservative in the race. And Stenberg was endorsed by Jim DeMint, the Club for Growth, and Freedom Works, groups that actually do vetting of your record, not just candidates, but groups who actually have paid researchers who look. So Stenberg was the most conservative. Now, he was not an upstart. In fact, he's been around a long time, and he's lost a lot of races. And I think he's kind of seen as a little bit of a career politician, and even worse, is sort of a boring... bad campaigning, losing career politician. So that was kind of Stenberg's problem. And then you have Deb Fischer, who, although her record is spotty and she had voted for gas tax increases and some other bad votes, she became identified as the Tea Party candidate, partly because she got Sarah Palin's endorsement kind of late in the game. What sort of happened, there's sort of two schools of thought about what happened. I tend to believe that what happened, my take is that this is essentially what happened, what allowed John Kerry to win Iowa, which was, remember, Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt essentially destroyed each other.
The murder-suicide.
And yeah, exactly. And so John Kerry snuck in. A better example actually is in South Dakota in 2002, when two top-tier, well-funded candidates destroy themselves, one guy named Kirby, another guy named Barnett, and this guy, Mike Rounds, who was, frankly, I was out in South Dakota. I watched one of these debates on TV in South Dakota. Mike Rounds was a joke. It was like a high school team going up against the Yankees and the Red Sox, if that was possible. And yet, they destroyed each other, and Rounds won. And I think that's kind of what happened here.
I mean, have you seen Deb Fischer in debates or in her ads? I mean, does she seem like a polished candidate, or does she seem like she's just not ready for primetime and got lucky?
No, I don't know much about her. The only thing that I'm going off of is the money and the endorsements and the polling, which was that early on it was thought that Bruning would win. He was the establishment favorite. He's sort of the moderate establishment favorite. They were all portraying themselves as conservative, and that sort of muddied this thing up, which is why it's totally different than Indiana. In Indiana, there was a longtime incumbent, Dick Lugar, who was clearly cast as the moderate establishment choice, and you had Richard Murdoch, who was clearly cast as the conservative alternative, and everyone sort of agreed on that. In this case, it was very muddy. The establishment guy, Bruning, was running as a conservative, but he was really the establishment guy. Everybody thought it was going to be Stenberg versus Bruning. Stenberg had the backing of the Club for Growth and Dement and Freedom Works. And really, for a long time, it was Stenberg and Bruning battling it out, spending millions of dollars against each other, including outside money. And what happened is, late in the game, Sarah Palin endorsed Deb Fischer, and Fischer essentially came out of nowhere, and her polling really surged at the end. And, I mean, we saw it coming. I knew a couple days ago that Fischer would probably win, but a week ago, even, that would have been a long shot.
Now, I haven't really seen Palin be all that politically active since she announced she wasn't going to run for president. So I guess, one, does this suggest that she still has juice in the conservative movement grassroots? I mean, obviously, it seemed to be the easy answer would be yes. But two, is she still looking to play? Does she still have some sort of long-range game plan now that even though the presidency might be off of her wish list at the moment?
Interesting question. I think, first of all, Palin, in my opinion, Palin's sort of reputation has increased since she's kept a lower profile. It's interesting how that can happen. Now, because Deb Fischer came out of nowhere and won, and it coincided with Palin's endorsement, this is a kind of a boon to the Sarah Palin industry and to her supporters. And she has endorsed others, like she's endorsed in the Texas Senate campaign coming up in about a month as well. So she has endorsed others. But I wrote something today at the Daily Caller that was a little controversial because, Palin has endorsed men and women, so I don't want to give the impression that she's only endorsed women. But on several occasions, she's endorsed women against more conservative men. And that happened again in Nebraska. It happened with Carly Fiorina. It's happened in New Hampshire. It's happened in other places. But again in Nebraska, Palin endorses Deb Fischer when Stenberg, I think empirically, certainly has a more conservative voting record just record.
Well,
than
Fischer. I mean, she's pushed the Mama Grizzly brand for a long time.
That is the speculation. And let me just read to you. Palin wrote a very, very brief congratulatory note on Facebook to Fischer. And in it, here's what caught my attention. It's a very short sort of congratulatory note. And in it, she mentions, let me pull it up here. I don't want to misquote her here. She mentions that Fischer isn't part of the, quote, good old boys network and adds, "I applaud moms like Deb Fischer." And what I wrote is Palin saying, to paraphrase another notable woman, that a wise mother with the richness of her experiences would more often than not make a better U.S. senator? I think it's an interesting question. Like, if Palin were to say, look, I'm generally going to pick the most conservative candidate, but if it's even close, I'm going to go with the woman. That's her decision. But I don't know that she's ever said that, but it seems that way.
Sure, sounds like a point of action to me.
It seems a little bit like she's showing a favorite.
She's some sort of quota queen.
It seems interesting, especially in the point you're making, Bill, of course, is that that's like an unconservative thing to do.
Yes.
I mean, the conservative thing would be to look at solely at merit. You can make a good argument, by the way, that we need more Republican women, that we need more women in the conservative movement. You could argue that, and that might be true, but that's also sort of unconservative, because the conservative notion, I think, would be let them fight it out, support the best person for the job, and it would be great if that best person sometimes is a woman or whatever, but that's not that shouldn't be a qualifying factor, or a disqualifying factor, for that matter.
Well, I mean, it's been talked about a lot that there is a big gender gap right now that the Obama campaign is trying to drive and exploit after these debates over contraception and transvaginal ultrasounds and things like that. And it seems like the Romney campaign hadn't really figured out a solution to that problem. I don't know if this quite is a solution, but is it wrong for Sarah Palin to say to the Republican Party establishment, hey, I have a way for you to appeal to women, and holding up women as being, you know, fresh, you know, not old boy network, as an embodiment of change. And this is how, you know, Democrats did this in 1992 when there was a Year of the Woman notion. And you know, part of the underlying argument was, or at least there's some evidence in polling and focus groups, that voters saw women as being, you know, being clean, not corrupt, straight shooters, and there was an intrinsic advantage at least in that year on that basis. Now, perhaps that sort of thing would not always be true once more and more women got into politics and folks saw them as being just as awful as everybody else. But if that notion exists today, why not try to use it to your advantage if you already have a problem with a gender gap that you're trying to close?
Well, it's an interesting thought. I guess before I get to that, think of the... I'm not convinced that Palin's endorsement was what put Deb Fischer over the top.
You think it's more the murder-suicide aspect?
I think so. But it certainly didn't hurt, and it very well might have helped. It probably did help. But imagine if you are a dude running for Senate, and you're more conservative, and you've fought. You know, you've got the scars on your back from taking on the labor unions or whatever. And you've gotten endorsements from conservative groups, social conservatives, fiscal conservatives. You've done a really good job campaigning. And 2 days, 3 days before the election, Sarah Palin endorses your more liberal female opponent. That would be tough. That would be tough to swallow. In this case, Don Stenberg wasn't going to win anyway. So Deb Fischer probably ended up stopping the more establishment candidate, Brunig, from being the from being the Republican nominee. So it was a positive result, but it doesn't mean that she couldn't have theoretically messed up something and prevented the more conservative candidate. I don't know how careful she is looking at these races. It could be that she is being very strategic and that she's being very cautious. But it does strike me that there's this really scary possibility, if you're a candidate out there running, that she could come in at the last minute. And if you're a conservative running against a woman, even a more moderate woman in a Republican primary, I think you have to stay up late at night, you know, or wake up worrying about this.
Or at least there's an argument perhaps to dispatch your team to Palin HQ and beg for her endorsement and not get blindsided.
Oh, yeah, you would... Think of the resources that are expended trying to stop endorsements from happening. Never mind getting endorsements, just keeping somebody on the sideline.
Right.
It's unbelievable. But to address your point, I do think it is possible that a political party, which is in a sense a brand, could decide we need to field more of this type of person. We need more African Americans who are getting the nomination. We need more Hispanics, whatever. That would not be an absurd idea from a branding position. And the problem is that it clearly runs very counter to conservative philosophy, which would say, number one, let's go with the person who's more conservative, because once they get in office, we're going to want, you know, the best predictor of future voting is past vote record, or, you know, so we want them to be conservative when in office, but also just the philosophy of merit, you know, the best person for the job, as opposed to propping up somebody based on race, religion, whatever.
Well, without
gender, ethnicity.
Obviously, I don't disagree with the basic point that we should judge people based on their merits. I don't think it's necessarily a left-right kind of concept. But having said that, I think conservatives might want to think about getting over this impediment in this excuse. Forgive me for being a little inarticulate, but it's not unusual in the history of politics to survey the landscape and determine that there are different constituencies that need to be reached out to in order to win. Whether I have to reach out to the steel workers or the Irish or the business owners. You know, there's camps of people that have specific interests, and you want to make sure you have a position, a message, a style that can appeal to different types of people. I mean, it's never going to be a machine-like country of automatons who all think and dress exactly alike. And it should not be strange that there are going to be, African-American issues or Latino issues or gay issues or Christian, Jewish, or Muslim issues or female issues or male issues. And I think there's plenty of strategizing in Republican circles how to reach different constituencies, generally speaking. But because there is this notion...
Bill, I think you're right. And therefore, I think to really get this campaign going right, we need to pick a very rich white Mormon.
Well, it certainly wasn't smart for someone on Romney's team to tell Politico we need a boring white guy as vice president. I mean, even that might be true. It's not the way you want to characterize it publicly. And obviously, whether the person's white or not really should be irrelevant. But just to finish my pitch, you know, the conservatives seem to have internalized this antipathy towards the idea of a multicultural society. And the notion that you would, you know, have a Spanish language portion of your website cuts against this notion that we should be a unified culture around one language, just something like that. And if you guys can get over that, and so you know what, it really doesn't have anything to do with our feelings about markets or regulation or whatever.
Well,
to say, you
I
know,
think
there's
no,
different
Bill,
constituencies
I,
out there,
I,
we should appeal to them. Then you guys might have an easier
but
time.
But I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. But I think there's a difference between changing your sales techniques and changing your product. And candidates are part of the product. And so, yes, if we can communicate to Hispanics in a different way, that would be something that I think is an easy – I would certainly – my son, by the way, is you know, going to be bilingual, like whether he wants to or not. Like, that's one of the things on my list of necessity. And so I think that, like, anything that's a matter of tactics fits under the sales, like, rubric. And you shouldn't be arguing or spending that much, like, burning that many calories over that. But the product, changing the product to sell it is a problem. And that's what picking different candidates is.
But wouldn't it be hard for the Republican Party if they really believed in, say, all the various social conservative issues, wouldn't it be hard if every Republican was an atheist? Wouldn't that be difficult to convince the evangelical Christians? You know, we don't have any evangelical Christians in our party, but we believe in having, you know, absence education and banning homosexuality and all that sort of stuff. Wouldn't that be hard? Wouldn't it be easier to say, you know what, we got some of your people on our team. You know, we don't have all of you people. We got some of your people. Isn't just inherently a validator?
That's another question. Does that work? Like, does fielding, would having Susana Martinez or Marco Rubio on the ticket help? Would that help Republicans with Hispanics? I'm not sure that the answer is yes. I mean, I'm not saying it's no. And right. I think that Martinez could potentially be a bigger help in that regard. But I think the jury is still out as to whether or not having, you know, prominently, you know, elected officials who are African American would help the Republican Party. Like, are the Republican Party better today because in terms of garnering black votes, are they further ahead today because they have Alan West and the congressman from South Carolina, help me out here,
Tim.
They're now two,
right?
Black Republican congressmen,
Tim Scott.
Congressman Scott, I think. So, but does that, are they? Are they at all better off?
You can't shortcut it. Look, Democrats made this mistake in 1984. We'll put Geraldine Ferraro on the ticket and we'll get the women's vote. And that did not work. So it can't just be having a silver bullet mentality. But just the party in general, it clearly, I think, has helped Democrats over the long haul to regularly recruit, to actually make a point. Let's make sure that over, if you look at the whole team, we're gonna have African Americans, we're gonna have Latinos, and we're gonna have faithful Christians, and we're gonna have Jews, and when we have the first Muslim congressman, we're not gonna, you know, pretend he's not there. We're gonna hold him up and say, look at our diverse party. And as the country has changed demographically, I think it overall is a net help that they got the goods. But if it's just going to be a window dressing, it's not going to help. And also you have to have a message to boot. Just having the person there, if the message isn't going to sell in that community, having a token is not going to help you either.
I think you're totally right. I think it has to be organic and it happens over time. And it's not like the silver bullet, as you said.
But I don't think conservatives should be apologetic if they want to recruit and say, let's do the extra effort, and this is sort of what, you know, Farage is supposed to be about, just to make sure you're doing the extra due diligence, that you don't have a blind spot, and if you have someone...
Well, they do. Here's the thing. I think that it is the job of party officials to recruit candidates. And you know, I heard a great story, and I believe it's true. It was told to me by John Gizzi, who is a human events, and he's sort of a walking encyclopedia of this sort of thing. But he said that the guy who was the chair of the RNC when they recruited Jack Kemp would every morning ask for newspapers from all around the country, but all he wanted to see was the sports section and the society, like, style section. He didn't want to see, and he would go through and he would pick candidates. Like, and that's how they got Jack Kemp, essentially, is finding people who were... They wanted different sports, actors, different things like that. And that's great for party people. But I think there's another sort of thing happening here, which is to say, and I see this with celebrities, right? Like, conservatives say they hate Hollywood, but they are the biggest. If you bring Kirk Cameron or anybody, if the Ultimate Warrior comes to CPAC, conservatives will go crazy about it. Because They're so desperate for celebrities. And I actually think the same thing is to a certain degree true with women, female candidates and other minorities right now. That Republicans are so desperate to prove to you that they are not what you think they are, that they have a sort of affirmative action thing. And I'm talking about conservative voters. And to me, it is problematic to vote for somebody who if you say that electing conservatives is your most important goal, and a lot of them say that, and then you vote for somebody who is not the most conservative based on another criteria, I think it's a little bit problematic.
Well, I guess, is Deb Fischer so much less conservative than Stenberg?
Well, based on my somewhat superficial examination, Stenberg is clearly the safer choice. He's much more likely to be a reliable conservative in the Jim DeMint sort of style than Deb Fischer. Having said that, we're always surprised by these things. There are people that you elect, and they do better than you think. I mean, she might end up being the next Ronald Reagan for all I know. This video could be a laughing stock in a few years. So you never know. But just based on observation, it seems like he certainly would have been the better choice if you're looking to elect a reliable conservative who's going to come to Washington and not sell out, not vote for tax increases, not vote for more spending. I would have felt more, a little bit, you know, more safer with him.
Safe-ish. We probably went deeper on this than I think either of us planned to. So.
This might be the deepest anyone has ever gone on the Nebraska Senate race.
That's what happened in the DMZ. It's very unpredictable. But there were a couple of big ideas we wanted to get to. Maybe we can't get to both of them. But which one did you want to take first?
I wish that we could throw it out to the audience and let them vote. But sadly,
we can't A/B test this, Matt. We just have to do it on our gut.
I could tweet it. Well, if you're okay with it, let's talk about the Ross Douthat thing. Because I think
he's going to be on your podcast soon.
He's coming on my podcast tomorrow.
He's got a book out?
He's got a new book out. And it's called Bad Religion. And I think all these big ideas are evergreen, so what the hell. Let's talk about this one. So Ross Douthat is coming on the podcast tomorrow. And but he gave an interview to some Canadian outlet. And despite the fact that it went to a Canadian outlet, I found it fascinating. And I wanted to just read you, if I can pull it up here, a little excerpt of it. Because he says, remember, his book's about religion. And he talks, and by the way, I've definitely seen him on Blogging Heads. I don't think he's a regular, but he's not unfamiliar to the Blogging Heads TV audience. But he says, when religious institutions are weak, as they are now, people with strong religious impulses are more likely to pour that fervor into politics. I argue that this takes two forms, messianic and apocalyptic. And he goes on to talk more about it, but that struck me as like really, really smart, and I think it's true. I think that there is an innate thing within humans, an innate desire to worship a creator, and I think you can believe that if you're not a believer, because that explains why there are all these crazy believers, and that explains why there's so many religions. But for whatever reason, humans have this desire to worship something, and I think Douthat is saying that if there are strong religious institutions that you can sort of direct that toward, that's one thing, but once these religious institutions begin to dissolve, more and more people will take that religious fervor and direct it toward politics. As he says, it manifests itself either in a sort of messianic way, which I think the worst examples of that would be kind of like the French Revolution, Soviet Union, the sort of utopian idea where we can monetize the eschaton. A much more tamer version has been alive and well here in America, and I think maybe Obama's 2008 candidacy certainly had some messianic flavor, although it's not solely a Democratic thing. And on the right, this apocalyptic thing, I think is, in fact, not only do I think it, but he was asked, Douthat was asked, what does he mean? And he says Glenn Beck. So This is Douthat. Obama's messianic campaign prompted an apocalyptic backlash, and Beck's popularity was the most obvious expression of that form. I don't know, it struck me as interesting. I thought I'd bring it up and we can chat about it.
I guess I not having read his book or his full argument, I may be speaking from a position of ignorance. I guess I don't understand.
Don't let that stop you, Bill.
Of course not.
I
am a blogger. I guess I don't understand his time. I actually can see examples of intersection of religion and politics being apocalyptic or messianic. I can see that. Him tying it to in periods of time when the religious institutions are weak. I guess I don't know what other period. I mean, you can say that's the case now. There's a certain decline in religious attendance.
Well, and a decline in not just, I mean, we talk that this is a recurring theme of this show is a decline not just in religious, but in all institutions.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Not just the church, but, you know, you don't work at the same place for 50 years. A lot of times you're not married to the same woman your whole life. You don't belong to the same political party. And if you do, parties are a lot weaker than they used to be.
It's about the lack of religion in business institutions or government institutions. There's all sorts
there's
of
like a sting like song. There's a Sting song about this,
right?
You know,
but I
if I ever lost my faith in you.
But is he arguing that religious institutions were weak in 1976 when evangelicals voted for Carter, or 1980 when Jerry Falwell started the Moral Majority? Was that the reason why there was an influx of religious political activity, or were there other reasons at that point? I don't know if he has an argument for that or an explanation for that. I mean, it seemed like there were different reasons that evangelicals responded to the fact that Jimmy Carter was very open to talking about his faith at a time when that was not done so often. And then Jerry Falwell took advantage of that initial taste of politics and said, great, now you're in this. Let's now use it in a way that really advances, you know, our specific agenda. And then folks responded to that. And not to mention Martin Luther King was a religious figure. Infused the cause of civil rights with scripture, and plenty of people responded to that call. Was that because institutions were weak then, or because King was a compelling figure with a very smart organizing strategy? Maybe Douthat has arguments for this. I haven't heard the argument that those things happened because institutions were considered weak at the time.
Well, okay, let me read a little bit more about what he says about the messianic version. He says both messianic and apocalyptic are mirror image heresies. He says the messianic form is where you assume that politics is the mechanism for bringing about the kingdom of heaven or on earth. So I think, and again, I'll talk to Douthat about this. Who knows? Maybe this will be something we come back to. I think my guess is what Douthat means is that. That America, if you look at things that have happened in other countries, for example, you know, during the Great Depression, America remained a democracy, but other countries succumbed to fascism, communism, other isms, which were messianic. I mean, look at Hitler and the signage and the trappings. Communism is in a way a religion. I mean, obviously they were atheistic, but in a sense, it's this utopian belief. David Brooks says that the essence of conservatism is what he calls epistemological modesty, which essentially means if you believe in a fallen world and original sin, then you wouldn't trust man, even yourself, to be able to manage a centrally, managed economy. If you're truly modest and you realize that you're basically an F up, that you won't think that you could have a national health care plan because you don't trust that you or someone like you could ever manage it. You have more faith in the invisible hand. And I think that's what he's sort of getting at here, is that America has always had a much stronger, has been much more religious than European countries. And again, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my speculation is that he would argue that that's one of the reasons we've avoided some of the problems that Europe has had. And I guess perhaps the conclusion is that as our religious institutions fall away, we may become more susceptible to being swept up by messianic political figures, or by like sort of, you know, right-wing apocalyptic political figures. And that's an incredibly dangerous thought.
I mean, he seems to be suggesting some level of discomfort with the current direction of conservative politics, that they are flirting with messianic political figures like Glenn Beck or apocalyptic notions of where America is headed. But he's always been considered someone who is probably the biggest social conservative on the New York Times editorial page. He's always talking about issues of abortion and contraception and the like. So I know he's not in the Mitch Daniels camp saying that Republicans shouldn't talk about these issues at all. But do you get where he's going with all this? How does he envision his brand of conservatism that certainly has religious social issues as part of the mix without veering into the messianic or the apocalyptic?
Good question. And I've mentioned this guy before, and I really think that if you want to understand, there's a guy named William Wilberforce that everyone should familiarize themselves with. And I wish conservatives read more about William Wilberforce and Edmund Burke and Churchill and Thatcher and Reagan and Dietrich Bonhoeffer than they did reading about the Rules for Radical Saul Alinsky guy. I think that to understand, and by the way, Romney in his speech at Liberty University this weekend referenced Dietrich Bonhoeffer and William Wilberforce, both of them. Wilberforce was a parliamentarian in Britain who basically ended the slave trade and ended slavery right before he died. I mean, he was the catalyst behind this. And to understand sort of the Ross Douthats of the world, and I don't know that he's a huge Wilberforce fan, but I suspect he is, but it's important for the audience, I would say, to familiarize themselves with him, because he is kind of the model, the very unsung hero and a very much underappreciated model for, I would say, for like social conservatives. And people tend to think that social conservatives are like Southern Jerry Falwell. The stereotype would be like uneducated, whatever, evangelical. And there certainly is an element, a faction of social conservatism. But there are a lot of people like Douthat who are, highly educated, not from the South. I don't know where he's from, but I presume it's not Mississippi, who fit, and it's like, well, how did this guy get to be that way? What is the world view? And a lot of them look to Wilberforce. I mean, Wilberforce is essentially the model that a lot of pro-lifers hold up when they look for what should a member of Congress be like, a sort of noble person who fought the good fight for 30 or 40 years to end an evil, because they would say abortion would be a parallel to it. So I think that Douthat fits into that description. But Wilberforce wasn't always happy. I think he had bouts of depression, but somewhat of a happy warrior. I mean, he wasn't like saying the end of the world is near, nor was he saying, look at me, I'm great, worship me. He believed in principle. So I think that's sort of the camp, and I'll shut up, but I think that's sort of the camp that Douthat comes from.
Well, folks can hear more about what Ross Douthat has to say on your podcast, which can be found where?
Yes. You can get it on iTunes under Matt Lewis and the News. You can go to mattklewis.com. Hopefully it'll be up in the next few days from the time this goes. Douthat's book is called Bad Religion. He obviously writes a column in the New York Times, so there's a lot, this won't be your only source of information, but I hope this spurs thought and debate, and it's an interesting conversation to have, and I really hope I haven't misrepresented any of his views. I've tried to quote from him as much as I can here.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this edition of the DMZ. Always good to talk to you, Matt.
Always good talking with you, Bill. And we'll see you all back here next week in the DMZ.
Take care.